I think the number one attribute that I've seen in a successful sales mindset is having that intellectual curiosity to learn for something in the future and always keep looking that 3 to 5 years in the future.
Welcome to the Selling to Enterprises podcast. This is Zia here, and that is the voice of Edward Wilson Smythe, a digital strategist and a trusted CXO advisor. Ed drew from his experiences and his unique vantage point as an advisor to share unbiased perspective on selling to enterprises in today's digital economy. Without further ado, let's get started.
This is going to be fun. Yeah.
Of course. So Ed, to get things rolling, tell us about your journey so far. Connect the dots for us, please. Thank you.
If I started connecting the dots, it would probably draw a pretty weird picture. My journey has been, I'd say, untraditional compared to the career paths we see of many other people in the industry. I started off traditional management consulting, PwC, A.T. Kearney, doing a bit of IT, but it was mostly traditional consulting and looking at technology strategy, et cetera. The big change happened for me, I think, at two periods in time. One, before I joined PwC, I was doing a lot of work with startups. And you can imagine in the early 2000s, startups were increasingly technology and internet. And as a result, I needed a crash course on what technology was. I was so naive in technology that in those old days when they showed me diagrams of, those lightning bolts that indicate internet, I thought they indicated that the building was waterproof. So that's how naive I was when it came to technology. And over time, it's been, I think a series of fortunate coincidences that led to one thing leading to another that moved me more and more into the technology realm and into the how do you use technology to drive business value lens. Given my background, I'm probably going to always be the least technical person in a room. Being able to tie in how does things impact business with whatever knowledge of technology I have has sort of been the career path for the last 20 years or so.
How B2B sales has changed, right? Predominantly in this digital economy. So let's get deeper into it. Take your time. Talk to us about that.
And I would link it back to sales changing because at any point in time, as technology has evolved and the role of technology in business has changed, how technology is articulated has changed as well in the business. So if you go back to, let's say, 40 years ago, 30 years ago, the focus on technology was selling in what we would now call, pejoratively widgets. But in those days, those were, assets. You sold in servers, you sold in mainframes, you sold in networks, and those drove exponential changes in business performance as compared to what existed before that. Pre 1980s, very few businesses were computerized. So getting computer infrastructure into businesses with the rudimentary applications that sat on that was a dramatic change. So the sales focused on how do I sell disruptive products? I think in the 90s, we saw two big shifts happening almost in parallel. The ability of enterprise applications to drive business improvements, let's just call it ERP for the purpose of this conversation, but other enterprise applications as well, as well as the emergence of the global delivery model. Those two things drove sales very differently than the previous generation, and it was more focused on how do I now enable those large enterprise transformation programs, still focused on technology, less business, more technology. Because think about it, if you had accounts payable, merely automating the capture of invoices through a system was a radical improvement in productivity and business performance. You didn't necessarily have to think about intelligence or process optimization beyond rudimentary automation, given where we were before that. So that wave focused a lot more on what I would call moving away from products to solutions. And you were selling technology solutions and increasingly getting clients comfortable with what now passes for ordinary, a complex global delivery model. I still remember, say, probably 10 years ago, one of the leaders I work with at one of the firms I work with I had never been to India. And actually, both, you know, two firms I worked with before had never been to India. And their logic was that they could provide advice to clients based on, you know, their accumulated years of wisdom and PowerPoint slides and Excel templates. And one of them said, well, I don't necessarily need to be in India to advise about India. And I thought that was rather silly. But that's how, you know, becoming more global in focus, getting our sales culture more comfortable, understanding the potential of global delivery, if not necessarily understanding global cultures. And then linking that to solutions was a big push, I'd say, in the 90s to the early, and up to the early part of the century. I think since then, sales has been on a very steady shift, an accelerating shift towards linking back to business value. If you go back to digital, and I'll go back to when I joined a smaller company, I was very progressive and was in charge of setting up the digital consulting practice. In those days, digital was still about SMAC, you know, social, mobile, analytics, and cloud. I don't think anyone in their right mind will describe digital in terms of four disparate, primarily technology utilities and capabilities. And from there, let's say 10 years from there to today, or even 7 years from there to today, the shift has very much become on how do you articulate the business value of innovation. So when I talk about B2B sales and enterprise sales, I'm still talking about selling technology concepts and innovation to clients. So in that space, and this is within a generation of many of our sellers, we've gone from selling product superiority based on product features to solutions based on application features and delivery models to truly articulating business value. And each one of those three things require very different mindsets on how we approach client problems, very different mindsets on how we articulate value propositions. And let's be honest, very different mindsets in terms of who we consider clients. One of the biggest challenges in enterprise sales today is, you know, and I actually do have a t-shirt, but I haven't got it printed out for other people that says, what got you there will not... Well, what got you here will not get you there. What that means is, let's say you're a senior level sales executive and you've been successful selling in product, selling in solutions, selling in global delivery models, largely to an IT audience, and you consider a trusted 10-year relationship with the CIO suite to be very valuable. That is no predictor of any success in selling in today, of the kind of value propositions client expect with the kind of competitive dynamics we have and being successful. So I think we've come to a point where there is a wholesale rethinking in sales of who my clients are, what I'm selling, how I'm articulating the value, and how I'm generating revenues for my company.
So let's look at the business side, right? In your opinion, what do you have seen? How has the buying behavior changed?
So I think the decision, if you talk about technology sales, there's always going to be an element of technology sales in the traditional managed services world that's going to be consumed primarily by IT, primarily through some form of a procurement process. That procurement process is becoming more collaborative, but it's still, in the broader sense, it's still a traditional procurement process. We were seeing the big shift. And that's a declining part of the business. So traditional data center management, application support are declining parts of any company's portfolio. We were seeing the explosive growth. You take cloud as a starting point, or take application modernization as a starting point, all the way into creating specific digital solutions to meet company needs, and then helping companies even with their go-to-market strategies, business model planning, et cetera. The customer for that is very different than the traditional corporate IT. In some cases, yes, corporate IT may still be leading it. Corporate IT may have a seat at the table, but the ultimate customer is a business leader of some sort. Second, the customer is no longer looking at technology. You know, if you remember the old ROIs we used to do, you invest X million dollars in technology, and the primary business case was technology cost savings or cost avoidance. increasingly the clients are looking at what business value does that drive. And if we cannot talk the language of business value, we will not be very successful in enterprise sales. The third is that the clients are looking for more than people who are, you know, reliable, cost-effective executors of a plan. They are looking for their technology and innovation partners to sit with them and help them develop the strategies, the plans, and then help execute it. I mean, if we go back to saying every business strategy requires a technology strategy, I would flip it around and say every technology strategy is a business strategy. And we have to start looking at anything we sell in the innovation space or the technology space with the lens of not only enabling business strategy. To me, that's table stakes. If we cannot articulate that, we're dead in the water. But there are cases where technology innovation will drive business strategy. If you think of some of the most disruptive business models out there today, the underpinning of that is technology innovation and how companies go to market, engage with their customers, drive revenues, drive margins, will increasingly be dependent on technology innovation enabling those conversations. So whether we talk about servitized business models where manufacturers are moving away from selling products into selling lifecycle service relationships, whether you talk about consumerized revenue models where manufacturers are moving away from asset-based sales into selling experiences and selling per-use models, none of that's possible without technology. So that leads technology enterprise sellers to operate in one of two modes. One, we sit back, focus on technology solutions, and let someone else drive the business strategy, and then we supply the reliable, cost-effective bodies to execute on the technology. Or we step up and help set the business strategy, because ultimately the answer to that business strategy is something that's rooted in technology innovation that's either being led by one of our companies or our companies are better at understanding and executing than a traditional management consulting firm. So the big push now with the shifting buying behaviors is how do we become that consulting-led, true consulting-led? And consulting does not mean being a technology functional consultant in a particular application suite. I think the word consultant is one of the most overused and abused words in the English language. And in our industry, we tend to call everybody a consultant. A true consultant focuses on business value and identifying ability to create business value. And a lot of technology enterprise sales has to start with that, as opposed to let's take something from the client and then reliably play that back. If we're waiting for the client to give us SLAs or functional requirements or architectural requirements, we've already lost because there's another person who is as good as implementing it as us, sitting with the client helping create all of that. So from my perspective, the way to be successful in this generation of B2B technology sales is to lead with business consulting and sit with the client and have a seat at that table in driving those business strategies that ultimately lead to technology strategies.
So in that scenario, how do some companies, see, your customers are obviously going through this particular transformation and there are not many examples and success stories out there right now. And similarly, the companies that will be working with them also do not have that kind of an experience, right? But they still have to sit with the client and give them the strategy. So how do they go about that in a scenario when even they have not done that in the past?
So I think that if we take a step back and look at the industry as it exists right now, there are enough success stories in the B2B enterprise technology companies to have a blueprint of how this works. Now, it's not 80% of any company's business. It's probably not something that has been codified and is something that is, replicated effortlessly across business units or across the industry, but there are enough examples of companies that are doing it very well. And I think those are the companies or those are the sellers who are winning in the marketplace. And to some extent, it doesn't matter what company you work for. It's the seller that's able to understand this conversation, understand how the technology conversations can be tied into the broader business discussion, the seller that can leverage best practices of how these sales have been done, maybe not even in their own companies, but in the industry. I think there's enough learnings in our industry to say there is a way to do this better than others. I think from our company's perspective, when you look at the clients, I have not seen a single client push back against a good business idea. So the challenges we typically face in convincing IT, you know, the middle management, permafrost, and IT to do things differently, because you know they had careers vested in being SAP experts, or they had careers vested in being network operations directors. And that created a significant bottleneck to innovation, let's be honest. I don't see that happening in the business because the business leaders have a much more direct, and we talk about leaders, I'm talking about C-suites and direct reports to C-suite. They have a much more direct traceability from business outcome to their own accountabilities, which is less the case in the way IT, traditional IT used to be done a decade ago. So I have yet to meet a business client who, when presented with a proposition of you can improve asset uptime by X percent, or you could increase lifecycle revenues from your customers by Y percent, sits back and says, no, thank you for this great idea, but I already have a way of doing this and we're going to do that. I think the challenge is a supply side challenge. It's not a demand side challenge, especially with the COVID disruptions. We've seen manufacturers invest during the COVID disruption of 2020, invest more in digital transformation because they know that not investing in innovation can be a life and death situation, especially with the kind of uncertainty that we see even without a global pandemic hitting us. So to me, it's less of a demand side challenge. It's more of a supply side challenge with the sellers. And the challenge is twofold. One, can we talk to the right client? So very often you end up with selling situations where we're trying to sell consulting-led digital transformation, but our historical work has been with directors of IT doing very good work, technical work in applications or infrastructure management or data management or whatever. They can be good advocates, but honestly, they may not even understand the topic being discussed, and they don't have the ability to advocate for or influence beyond, you know, vouching for a particular company being a good, reliable partner. So identifying the right client and who the client is that has a vested interest in those outcomes and who can make a decision becomes critical. And very often, that's not going to be corporate IT. It's definitely not going to be directors of corporate IT. It may be the CIO. Starting with that, and then how do you articulate a solution? And let me be clear about that. In technology sales, we have a habit of creating sales catalogs, almost like a Chinese menu, showing everything that we can offer. We are enamored of our own prowess. So we love to talk about how many thousands of people we have in global delivery centers and how many gold level partnerships we have with the ERP vendors and how many certifications we have with the cloud platforms. You know what? Everybody has that. That's table stakes. If you're not a gold and platinum partner of an ERP, and if your people are not certified in the cloud platforms, you know, that's table stakes. That's not a differentiator. If you don't have delivery centers in global markets. So talking about that and talking about our tools and templates really goes nowhere. But we're used to selling that way because 15 years ago, those were disruptive ideas. Setting up a delivery center in a tier two Indian city was a basis for competitive advantage 15 years ago. 20 years ago. It's table stakes today. What really drives a change is, can we understand what are the top three, top four business challenges a client is facing and find a way to solve that using technology and innovation? To me, those two become the key barriers to, and if you flip it on its head, enablers of success in B2B sales today. Can we identify the right client and have something relevant to say to them? And second, can we identify the 3 to 5 business challenges that a client is facing and come up with a point of view that reasonably leads the business to believe we can solve it for them.
At an individual level, so I know you already touched upon some of those attributes, but what are the key attributes an enterprise seller should have now? That's one. And second is how should the sales heads kind of enable them, right? They enable the existing sales teams to kind of change along with the market and become successful out there.
On the first one, I have probably 10 years of working with Larson. I work for NTT Data now, but before this as a consultant, I was working with several of the large technology companies, including Zia, how we met, advising them on go-to-market strategies and competitiveness strategies. I think from an enterprise sellers, the one thing I'd say is at some point in our careers, this is human nature. It's nothing to do with technology, nothing to do with selling, but at human nature, at some point in our careers, our lens becomes more retrospective than prospective. We've achieved a certain level of success doing whatever we have, whatever that might be. We have achieved a certain level of financial stability that comes with that success as we define it. And as a result, we start focusing on all the things that got us to where we were. Some of us do that arrogantly. Some of us just do that because that's human nature. I think the number one attribute that I've seen in a successful sales mindset is having that intellectual curiosity to learn for something in the future and always keep looking that 3 to 5 years in the future. That's very tough to do because sellers are, as you know, incentivized on short-term revenue results. Some companies will evaluate the sellers on a quarterly basis. Every company evaluates the sellers on a month, on an annual basis. So how do you balance that imperative to drive short-term financial results? So let's be honest, a dollar is a dollar. A dollar doing traditional services that may have a 3-year horizon versus a dollar from doing cutting edge innovation is still a dollar. It still hits EBITDA the same way, a dollar of margin. So to some extent, at the level of the seller and the sales leader, the quality of earnings is less important than the quantity of earnings, because that's what the analysts are looking at. That's what share prices are driven by. But the seller and the VP as VP level sales leader, they are focused on delivering those short-term revenues and margins. How to balance that with having that longer term view and pushing your portfolio towards the future and being intellectually curious enough to realize that the behaviors, mindsets, skill sets that led to success for the past X number of years may not lead to success in the future is, I think, the toughest thing for enterprise sellers who have been successful for the last X number of years to do. For new enterprise sellers that are just joining the industry or 5 years in the industry, it's relatively different because they are born digital. It's either going to be obvious whether they can compete with these mindsets or attitudes or not. But for people who have been successful in the previous modes of selling, being open to change, and I'll give you a very specific example. In another firm I used to work in, there was a very large, traditional sourcing advisory group. And the mindset of many people in that group who'd been very successful in sourcing advisory was that cloud is still 3 years or 5 years away. It didn't matter when you had the conversation with them. 5 years after working with them, they still say cloud is 3 to 5 years away. And then eventually they're still saying that when all the customers are moving to the cloud and they're wondering why they're revenues are declining and why their personal earnings are declining. And the lesson learned for any enterprise seller in the technology world is that change will happen whether we're ready for it or not, whether we like it or not, whether we understand it or not. Change in our industry is being driven by people who are at a far different level. And our ability to influence that change and slow it down to our comfort zone is non-existent. This isn't like managed services where you could get a renewal with a director of IT by giving them a 5% discount to stop them from going to an RFP. And you, the business case would be, I'll give you the discount, renew me for 3 years, saves you the trouble of paying someone $500,000 for an RFP, spends you the trouble of paying someone, you know, X million dollars for transitioning. You don't lose any knowledge. In that world of 10 to 15 years ago, that was acceptable. And many of our technology companies, you know, we proudly say 85% of deals are renewed because of the challenges, inertia of shifting. But now you'll talk to the same companies who've been very successful selling in that mode. And they'll tell you that 75% of their renewals are lost in traditional services. Because the comparison isn't just another vendor doing roughly similar things with slightly more automation, with slightly lower cost, versus you giving a discount and saving on RFP and transition costs. The competition is someone approaching that entire solution in a fundamentally different way. And sellers who can do that are being very successful. Sellers, clients, sales leaders who are unable to do that, or in some cases, unwilling to do that, advisors, consultants who are unable to do that, unwilling to do that, are seeing that impact their results. And we are seeing in our clients, you know, a wholesale generational change in IT leadership because there's a portion of IT leadership that's grown up in the last 15 to 20 years that is doing very well keeping up with the trends, and there's a portion that isn't. Similarly, there's a portion of traditional consultants and advisors that are doing very well keeping and a portion that aren't. And the same thing applies to sellers and sales leaders. So I'd say, yes, there'll always be those short-term, quarterly, or annual targets. How you manage that while pivoting your existing portfolio away from that traditional mindset is probably the number one determinant of success or failure in B2B technology sales today. And by these, I'm talking about companies that are not born digital. So if you are a SaaS startup, or if you are one of the large public hyperscale cloud providers, this is probably less relevant to you than to the large, you know, $10 billion, you know, $5 billion, $10 billion plus system integration companies. And all of us have grown up in a very similar way. We've grown up in different markets, different times, but all of us have grown up working on those various waves of innovation that came before this current wave. And a large part of our revenues and our installed base is still in the traditional services. How we modernize that while driving to the future becomes a number one determinant of success or failure.
Going back to your time as an advisor to the CXOs, not just with you in your current role, but also previous life, you had this unique vantage point and unbiased view of how the sellers or vendors are interacting with the CXOs or the clients that you used to work with, right? So is there anything that you can share in terms of what was working or what did not work, the best practices around that from those interactions?
It's let me start with what worked, and I'll give you sort of some of the best examples of where this has worked. And I name these companies because, you know, they're very well known for what that worked. What it really worked was if you're working with a CIO, the CIO was a true business leader. You know, in some cases, the CIO did come from the business. In some cases, the CIO grew up the technology ranks, but understood business and had a seat at the table. So the best examples of where this innovation worked was where the conversation was all about business value. I'd say looking back, you know, the work I did at Toronto Pearson Airport, you know, probably would rank as some of the most satisfying work that I did. Now, this was a client that was suffering from a very legacy, I'd go beyond traditional. I'd say, you know, very traditional approach to technology services. The way we would all recognize from, you know, 15, 20 years ago. With a new CIO in place, coming from the business, and driving a focus on business outcomes, we were having conversations with other C-level executives on what would drive foundational change in their operations. And if you look at an airport that goes from being the worst rated airport in Canada and suffering from delays because they ran out of de-icing fluid. So Zia, you live in upstate New York. The chances you run out of salt and warm clothes in a winter in the I-90 corridor, probably not very high, right? So think about an enterprise that was planning things so poorly that they could not plan for de-icing fluid while operating an airport in Canada. From that to go to the number one rated airport in North America many years running, to being the second largest North American airport for international travel after JFK. Wow. And it's, I'd say, you know, yes, everyone plays a role in that, but CIO was central in that. And the relationship with the CIO was not looking at, you know, the 140 SLA spreadsheets that sourcing advisors would provide. And, you know, he was really looking at how do I drive business innovation? So we created a list of more than 20 business initiatives that required to be implemented to get this airport to where it needed to be. They also found a partner, and Zia, you work for them, you know, who came to the table in a very different mode of operating when there were other partners that went to the trouble of writing letters saying that not only was this business model something they couldn't support, but this was a business model that was so unworkable that no one in the industry could support that. So when you think about old sales mindsets, some sales leader signed off on that letter. And some sales leader went all the way in and collaboratively worked with the client to create an incredible relationship and solution. And then over time, also looking at the partnership with Microsoft and moving, you know, very traditional data centers to what is now what just won an award for being the best Microsoft enterprise Microsoft project in Canada. And you know, to me, there are examples like that everywhere. So in my current firm, we're working with a company, and I will not give you the name because I don't think it's as publicly known as the other example I just shared, that is looking at, you know, they're in the food business, food ingredients business. You could argue, you know, it's production. No one knows what products you produce. You know, it's you know, build plants, make wheat. But they are driving significant innovation, not only in their production and supply chain operations, but they're actually getting insight into who their real customers are. Because if you think about it, food is probably the most emotional purchase category in the world. We don't think of it that way. You know, we think of sneakers and vacations and cars and travel, housing. But food is the number one emotional purchase that any one of us make, and we make it every day. This company is developing insights into how end consumers are reacting to product innovation they're driving. So product innovation being non-meat proteins, product innovation being non-sucrose, non-aspartame sweeteners. So now that you start thinking of food being beyond ingredients that are sold to manufacturers who make into stuff that sell to supermarkets, who sell to customers, and start thinking of food being at the intersection of three major trends, global trends that are driving how people look at the relationship with the earth. One, sustainable farming. Two, industrial animal farming. And three, the obesity epidemic in developed countries and some emerging economies. When you as a business leader are able to conceptualize your business at the intersection of three fundamental, I wouldn't even say generational, I'd say once in a thousand year consumer trends that we're living through right now, driven by awareness of climate change, driven by awareness of the kind of lifestyles that led to an obesity and diabetes epidemic in the developed world in the last 50 years. All of a sudden, we are working with clients that are we're working to solve those problems and not just how do you keep the IT uptime at a certain percentage. Now, I know the seller very well. I know the relationship we have with the seller, and it's all about those behaviors we talked about. It's a combination of business customers and IT customers. And you'll see unusual champions arise. So people, and that's why I'm not a big fan of names in boxes, because, you know, names in boxes are a function of a retrospective view of the organization. People end up in roles because of what they've done in the past, not necessarily what they can do in the future. That's just the nature of large companies. But even with those challenges, you'll see leaders emerge who have the right mindset, the right skill set, both in companies and in our sales organization. All we need to do is find the right governance model for them to work together. And when we are able to do that, and no one's able to do that consistently across 100% of the business, and that's our challenge of this generation of sellers and sales leaders. But when we do that, we see the conversation elevate to a very different level, where we see the types of solutions being discussed, even though they are technology solutions, be very different than the types of managed services discussions we had from 10 years ago. And you know, if you take those two examples and the many others, you start seeing how technology becomes elevated to be an enabler of business, but also leading the business in some cases. And then the technology companies truly being seen as business partners and not just technology executors. Where it doesn't work, and there have been many instances where it doesn't work, and it doesn't work because you're talking to the wrong person based on wrong assumptions based on history, and someone else is talking to the right person based on the right assumptions based on the future.
Talk to us about the role of culture in the sales transformation. And as you know, culture is also pretty important in terms of how companies also select a vendor, right? So If you can spend a few minutes on that.
Yeah. And I think culture, you know, culture has been the number one determinant of success, even if you go back to, You know, the heydays of when, you know, the companies like EDS and GM defined the first generation of outsourcing, or GE and, you know, Tata's defined the first generation of outsourcing. But how we define culture has changed. So culture, two generations ago, was about, could our workforce be seen as an extension of your workforce? I mean, if you go back to, and I remember very early in my career, there were still accounts which were, you know, the traditional large monolithic outsourcing accounts. And the number one thing we used to talk about is, you know, does your workforce look like the extension of my workforce? You know, you go back to, you know, you go to any Indian delivery center and, you know, you see, you know, pictures of the cities they're supporting, you know, branding of the brands they're supporting, you know, to create that culture. So culture started off as being, are you like me or am I like you? We went through a phase where we all needed a crash course on international culture as IT service delivery internationalized. But let's be honest, it was not an even two-way street. For every Western client that decided to wear a sari or a kurta, there were thousands of Indian technology workers that changed their accents, gave themselves new names, learned the weather patterns of the cities they were supposedly serving, and et cetera, et cetera. So to my point, that was just colonization by another way. It wasn't a true cultural, you know, journey.
Sure.
It was essentially, you know, just like the previous generation of colonizers. And now you realize I'm not a technology person. I'm an economics grad. I am working on a PhD in sociology, but I do see things sustainably in terms of culture in this definition as just, you know, can you work together? So that generation of neocolonial globalization rapidly changed because, you know, if you go back to, you know, Friedman and Nilekani and the world is flat, I always used to say, and I know you deal with young professionals from around the world who actually believe the world is flat because, you know, they went to the top schools and they worked very hard and, you know, they had the job in the top companies and they were building great lives for themselves. And I said, yep, the world is flat, until you meet the U.S. consul officer that's going to approve your visa, right? Then all of a sudden, the world is not very flat at all. Culture was always a question of one culture having to emulate the other culture because of the structural barriers that were set in place in a world that was not yet flat. If you fast forward to today, in a world where I can hire people in Canada cheaper than I can hire people in Mexico or Costa Rica, I'll just let that sink in. I can hire people in Canada cheaper than I can hire people in Mexico or Costa Rica.
Yep. Yep.
All bets are off. The pandemic has driven a very different view of location. It has forced us to interact with people who we would have interacted with in a very different way before. And it's also created an awareness, and this is emerging in the leading emerging countries, that geography is not a barrier to ambition. So Zia, if you think about the generations of people that have come to the United States in search of a better life, and you know, been very successful and added tremendously to the United States economy, society, and culture, those same people are reassessing what it means to be successful versus what it means to move versus what it means to retain cultures. So culture today is becoming about how we can truly engage with the global workforce as true equals. And that's a very tough thing to do because no industry has grown up in the context of true equality. So from our perspective in technology companies, it is about creating an environment where innovation can come from anywhere. This is not just about workers in certain countries being reliable workers and innovators in another geographies being innovators. Innovation can come from anywhere. And we are building organization structures and organization cultures that support that. In client companies, and we saw that in the company that we first met, was 70% of the production was happening in East Asia. And over time, the center of gravity of leadership of those companies necessarily moves to where the clients are and where their assets are. So in today's world, the culture is about how can you get to that right mix of global talent and mindset and engage them without those traditional barriers of who we expect to play what role. And that to me, that's the heart of innovation. That's why Silicon Valley has been so successful. That's why clusters of success in Bangalore or Monterey have been very successful. That has not permeated into traditional corporate organizations or corporate IT yet. But as we become more driven by innovation, as we become more driven by technology driving competitive advantage, you're seeing that manifest itself in traditional companies, traditional system integration companies much faster. So for me, the culture is less about, the airport test, right? I mean, I would never pass the airport test, let's be honest. So the airport test would not support innovation from someone like me. The airport test, would you like to spend time at the airport with somebody? And why is that important? We don't even fly anymore, right? Think about the airport test in a world where no one flies for business anymore, right? How weird that sounds. Culture is about, can you create an environment that's welcoming, supportive, and open enough to get the best ideas from the right people, wherever they may be in the world? And companies that move there, and technology companies that move there, and sales organizations that move there will be successful.
One final question, Ed. I know you are a co-author of an Amazon bestseller. Tell us a little bit more about that book, if you don't mind.
Oh, yeah. So that book was written when I was at Avasant. So Avasant's management consulting firm that I joined in 2014, part of the reason of joining that was, very dynamic CEO, very dynamic forward-facing leadership. And the book was about, and the book is a little dated. It's about 2018. So again, anything being retrospective. But the book was about how the technology innovation that we are seeing today, how that can not only drive better corporate outcomes that we all know about and talked about through this podcast, but how it can drive, you know, what I call the new human renaissance. So this is about innovation in its broadest sense, serving the broader human community in its broadest sense. And the proposition of the book was that all the innovation we are seeing in technology, all the business value that we're creating has a great potential of unlocking human potential if we let it and if we purposefully guide it to that direction. So the discussion we just had about a world where, which is flatter and where career potentials are not constrained by accidents of birth, that is possible because of technology. A world where people are freed from, you know, dangerous and routine and, you know, work without a future, but then not just discarded to unemployment, but reskilled and repurposed for the next generation jobs, which are, by the way, mostly technology jobs, that has a potential to unlocking the human potential. So it is about how we purposefully leverage innovation, not only to drive business, we have to do as table stakes now, but how do we drive that to truly unlock the most human potential that's possible? And we're seeing examples of that all over. If you think about manufacturing in Industry 4.0, every previous wave of automation has been directly related to a decline in employment because automation and employment are, and it's always been seen of how much can you get productivity so you need less people to do the same work. This generation of automation is looking at how do I reskill the people to do the new work that I need to do that didn't exist until innovation made it possible. We are seeing that in health outcomes in healthcare. And this is work my company is doing in healthcare, both in terms of robotics as well as terms of, you know, miniaturized devices, as well as in terms of using health data more effectively. And it's not just about health outcomes, but about health outcomes being equitable. I mean, we've all been through a pandemic, and in the United States, Black, Latinx, and Indigenous communities were 3 to 4 times more likely to be impacted by the pandemic than other communities. So it's not just how do you leverage technology for health outcomes, but how do you leverage technology for health equity? Those are the kinds of concepts the book explored 3 years ago. You know, looking back, I'm glad to say the book was to some extent ahead of its times because we're seeing progressive companies, including mine right now, really commercialize those solutions at scale. So it's no longer just ideas. It is about things I'm seeing in the market that's happening by, you know, leading companies, including my own, driving some of those innovations and outcomes.
Ed, you know, thanks for taking the time to come on the pod today. Really great points. You know, greatly appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Zia. All the best.
Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please do subscribe to the podcast, and I will greatly appreciate if you can leave a review. If you have any suggestions for future guests or any feedback, please write to me at zia@sellingtoenterprises.com. See you on the next episode. Thank you.